From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I found an unexploded bomb on my front porch and an unexploded missile on my back porch. And I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight. I mean, I can't even go in my backyard because the grass is high and you just can't go back there. You don't know where you're going to step. Your next step might be your last step.
Unexploded cluster bombs litter southern Lebanon. We'll get a special report from Democracy Now!'s Anna Nogueira. And we'll look at landmine legislation in Washington. Then more than 80 military recruiters were disciplined last year for sexual misconduct with potential enlistees.
He said to her outright, if you want to join the Marines, you have to have sex with me. She was a virgin. She was 17 years old, so she had sex with him eventually.
We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning AP reporter who broke the story. And in Mexico, Oaxaca heats up. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amnesty International has accused Israel of committing war crimes by deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure in Lebanon. The human rights group criticized Israel for destroying homes, bridges, roads, supermarkets, water treatment plants, and fuel tanks. Meanwhile, the United Nations has revealed Israel's dropped cluster bombs on at least 170 villages and other places in South Lebanon. Many of the cluster bombs failed to initially explode and still pose a danger. The devices are known to have killed 8 people and wounded at least 25 since the ceasefire began. We'll have more on cluster bombs later in the broadcast. The UN Development Agency is reporting Lebanon's 15-year economic and social recovery from civil war has been wiped out over the last month. The UN estimates the Israeli attack caused $15 billion in damage. About 35,000 homes and businesses were destroyed in the conflict. 80 bridges and 94 roads were destroyed or damaged. Israel's announced it will maintain an aerial and naval blockade of Lebanon until international troops arrive in southern Lebanon. On Tuesday, a top UN official said it could be months before the international force is in place. This is UN envoy Terje Rød-Larsen.
There is now a security vacuum, which the Lebanese government is trying to fill, and the international forces are assisting the Lebanese government in order to fill that vacuum. But I think realistically, up to a point, you will have such a vacuum in Lebanon for the next two, three months.
Meanwhile, in Beirut, Lebanese Prime Minister Fouad Siniora accused Israel of breaking the 10-day-old ceasefire.
I really don't find it strange that the Israelis continue to make skirmishes and attacks here and there. So this is similar to what they did a few days ago in the Bekaa area. So they are making the same thing in one way or another. I think the best thing for them is to comply with the resolution 1701 and to expedite the process of withdrawal as soon as possible.
Greenpeace Lebanon has revealed the oil spill off the Lebanese coastline has spread into the seabed and could threaten marine life for years. Oil on the seabed is so thick it can be physically picked up by divers. The spill occurred 6 weeks ago when Israel bombed an electric power plant. Up to 15,000 tons of fuel oil leaked out, but the Israeli military blocked any cleanup for a month. This is Zeina Al-Haj, Greenpeace coordinator in Beirut.
What we've seen is miles and miles of oil suffocating the seabed. Yeah, this is an indication that the contamination from the oil spill has spread beyond the shore, beyond the water coastline, into the underwater. And that is an indication of the urgency needed to deal with this disaster.
In the occupied territories, the Palestinian parliament held a special session Tuesday in solidarity with the abducted and detained members of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Since June, Israel's detained almost one quarter of the members of the Palestinian parliament. All the detained lawmakers are members of Hamas. On Tuesday, an Israeli military court charged Palestinian parliament speaker Aziz Dwaik with being in a terrorist organization. The Iraqi government has decided it will establish its own commission to investigate the rape and murder of a 14-year-old girl by U.S. soldiers. On March 12th, soldiers broke into the home of the teenager, Abir al-Janabi. According to military records, a U.S. soldier named Stephen Green herded Abir's mother, father, and five-year-old sister into a room and shot them dead with an AK-47 rifle. Green and another soldier then raped Abir, shot her, set her body on fire in an apparent effort to cover up the crime. The Iraqi government investigation is going ahead despite U.S.-imposed rules that prevent the Iraqi government from prosecuting crimes committed by U.S. service members. The number of U.S. troops in Iraq has increased to 138,000, but the military is facing a tough time finding enough soldiers to fight. On Tuesday, the U.S. Marines announced they're beginning an involuntary recall of inactive service members to return to duty and go to Iraq and Afghanistan. This marks the first involuntary recall by the Marines since the early days of the war. As many as 2,500 inactive Marines will be initially recalled. Meanwhile, a new CNN poll has found opposition to the war in Iraq has reached a new high. 61% of Americans say they oppose it. Just 35% favor the war. In Baghdad, an Iraqi Kurd told Saddam Hussein's genocide trial today she was horribly burned and lost three children after aircraft bombed her mountain village with chemical weapons. The woman, Adiba Aula Baez, said that she suffered two miscarriages after the 1987 attack. On Tuesday, another Kurd, Ali Mustafa Hafa, described the day his Kurdish village was attacked.
I saw 2 to 8 jets patrolling the sky. It was not easy to count them. They bombarded Balisan and Sheikh Hussan villages. The sound of the bombs was different from the others. The sound of the blast was lower than the usual bombs.
Ali Mustafa Hafa said most of the survivors began vomiting soon after the attack. Iran has indicated it's willing to negotiate with Western nations over its nuclear program, but Tehran gave no sign that it would freeze its uranium enrichment program. Tuesday marked the deadline for Iran to respond to a series of trade incentives offered by the United States and other countries. This is John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
We've also made it clear that their unwillingness to give up their pursuit of nuclear weapons will result in our efforts in the Security Council to obtain economic sanctions against them. So the choice for 2.5 months now has been with Iran, and if, in fact, as we expect, this is the definitive response today, we'll know which path they've chosen.
Meanwhile, the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations urged the international community to focus not on Iran's nuclear program, but on Israel's. This is Bashar Jafri.
What I know is that Israel, on a piece of land not exceeding 20,000 square kilometers, has 8 nuclear centrals capable of fabricating plutonium, uranium, everything necessary to fabricate nuclear bombs. And everybody knows that Israel has at least 300 nuclear bombs.
In news from Washington, former undercover CIA officer Valerie Plame is considering suing former Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage for leaking her identity to the press. The Associated Press has determined that Armitage met with Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward in mid-June 2003, the same time the reporter has testified an administration official first talked to him about Valerie Plame. In Illinois, an environmentalist who spoke up at a recent public hearing has found himself the target of an FBI investigation. On July 25th, Jim Benzman attended a public meeting on the proposed construction of a bypass channel for fish at a dam on the Mississippi River. Benzman has been a longtime critic of the system of locks and dams. At the public meeting, Benzman suggested the dam could be destroyed. It was an idea the Army Corps of Engineers had publicly mentioned as an option. Less than a week later, an FBI agent called Benzman to determine if he was a terror threat. Conservative commentator and former Republican presidential candidate Patrick Buchanan is calling for an immediate moratorium on all immigration. Buchanan claims such a measure is needed in order to keep the United States a predominantly white country. He writes in his new book, quote, "If we do not get control of our borders by 2050, Americans of European descent will be a minority in the nation their ancestors created and built." Here in New York, 20 activists with the group Jews Against the Occupation were arrested Tuesday for staging a die-in at Penn Station. Dressed in black, the activists lay down outside the train station during morning rush hour. In California, 20 people were arrested outside the San Francisco Jewish Center. This is Ora Weiss of Jews Against the Occupation.
Today, here at Penn Station in New York City, we were a group of Jews joining groups of Jews in Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and San Francisco expressing our outrage at Israel's brutal attacks on Lebanon and Gaza and demanding that the U.S. government stop sending political, economic, and military aid to Israel to fuel their attacks on innocent civilians.
And in Oaxaca, Mexico, fears are rising that the police will raid a dozen radio stations that were seized Monday by striking teachers. On Tuesday, several thousand people marched in silence carrying the coffin of Lorenzo San Pablo Cervantes, the architect shot dead yesterday outside of one of the radio stations where he was volunteering. Freelance journalist John Gibler is in Oaxaca. He describes a tense scene on the streets.
Between 1 and 2 a.m. on August 22nd, groups of police riding in pickup trucks, armed with machine guns and pistols, some dressed as civilians and others in uniform, made rounds throughout Oaxaca City, firing at radio stations that had been occupied by the Oaxaca People's Assembly protesters. Police shot in the back Lorenzo San Pablo Cervantes, an architect, who died 45 minutes later in the hospital. The roaming police also fired on two photographers from the national newspapers Milenio and Reforma, though no one was injured, and they threw a Molotov cocktail into the car of two teachers traveling to one of the different encampments, both of whom suffered second-degree burns. Last night, rumors ran through the city that the big raid was coming, and businesses closed several hours early in the evening, and the people from the Oaxaca's assembly all prepared. But then, rumors have it that after an 11 p.m. national television show showing the police making rounds the night before, that the operation was canceled. The mood throughout the city throughout the night has been very tense. Bonfires kept in the streets and streets blocked off, but there have been no reports of shootouts throughout the night.
John Gibler reporting from Oaxaca. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. For images of what's happening in Oaxaca, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Since a UN-brokered ceasefire came into effect 9 days ago, tens of thousands of displaced Lebanese civilians have returned to their homes in southern Lebanon. While Israel's bombing of the south may have ended, it left a deadly legacy in its wake, unexploded cluster bombs. Israel dropped thousands of cluster bombs on at least 170 villages in south Lebanon during its month-long war against Hezbollah. The bomblets failed to explode are now a deadly trap for civilians. Democracy Now!'s Anna Nagara went to South Lebanon. She filed this report.
When Bilal Beydoun returned to his village of Bin Jebel 1 week after the ceasefire, he discovered the war was not over.
I found an unexploded bomb on my front porch and an unexploded missile on my back porch. And I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight. I mean, I can't even go in my backyard because the grass is high and you just can't go back there. You don't know where you're going to step. Your next step might be your last step.
The United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon estimates that Israel dropped approximately 150,000 bombs during the 34-day military offensive. Many of these remain unexploded, even as villagers return home to start clearing away the rubble. The large unexploded missiles, while extremely threatening, are easier to find. It is the estimated 15,000 cluster bomb munitions, each carrying anywhere from 80 to 600 small bomblets, that pose the most immediate threat. Mark Garlasco is the senior military analyst for Human Rights Watch.
The use of submunitions here in Lebanon really is at a crisis point. We're seeing the contamination levels far higher than many areas during the Iraq War. Interestingly, though, we've also seen the exact same cluster bombs used here that were used in Iraq, and these same weapons were the main killers of civilians during the war in Iraq in 2003. We've seen dud rates from the American submunitions, which are not manufactured particularly well, on paper 14%, but in the field 30 to 40%. So the American stuff is much, much worse than the Israeli manufactured. And primarily, the Israelis have been using American weapons.
21 people have been injured and 4 killed from these unexploded ordnances in the week since the ceasefire took effect. In Nabatea, an 11-year-old boy was killed after stepping on an unexploded bomb in front of his house. His father, running out to help him, stepped on another and died 72 hours later. Not even the hospital grounds where many of these patients are being taken are safe. Dr. Fuad Faha shows us around the hospital in Bin Jebel, where we counted six visible unexploded devices, including a 500-pound missile in the backyard.
The day before yesterday, we had three kids who were playing with one of these bombs, and it exploded among them, and all of them got injured. One of them has all his intestines out. The other two girls were badly injured on their chest. We transferred them to Saida because we didn't finish. The operation room wasn't really ready because of what happens over here.
Human Rights Watch says Israel could face legal action for their use of these types of munitions in civilian areas. Although the weapons are not themselves banned, the Geneva Conventions prohibits their use in civilian areas. This is Nadim Houri, head researcher of Human Rights Watch in Lebanon.
I mean, there are very serious legal ramifications. By using these cluster munitions in areas where there are civilians, Israel not only endangered people at the time of the attack, but they created minefields for that villagers are coming back to today. And we have, you know, counted over 30 villages so far where people are coming back to their homes to find unexploded ordnances in their living room, in their patios, on their rooftops, and in their cars. And this is truly very dangerous, and it is a violation of the Geneva Conventions to do so.
Andrew Gleason of the Mine Action Group has been working to demine the region. He estimates it will take 1 year to 18 months for complete clearance of populated areas. But that does not include farms and fields, which are also littered with these bombs.
At the moment, we're prioritizing people, houses, and roads, and later we will target the fields of agriculture that require clearance as well. The agricultural land is a concern for two reasons. One, people may go into the agricultural land and land without knowing that there's munitions there. And the second is, people may take the risk. We heard some tobacco fields are contaminated. It's harvesting time for tobacco fields. And that means people might go in and recover that tobacco and take the risk because it's part of their economy.
In every town, anxious citizens toured us around their homes where so many of these bombs lie scattered amongst the ruins. They mark them off with stones and red spray paint in the hopes of avoiding more injuries.
Come walk in this yard. You can see all the bombs around you. You might step on one of these, you can't see it. Boom, killed you.
For Democracy Now!, this is Anna Noguera with Jackson Allers in Lebanon.
Anna reported after she filed the story that the number of casualties from unexploded ordnances has risen to 8 people killed and at least 25 wounded. For more on the story, we're joined by longtime peace activist Quiva Butterly. She's in southern Lebanon, where she's helping with rebuilding efforts and working to raise awareness about the leftover cluster bombs. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Quiva Butterly.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us about the situation there and exactly what you're doing?
We're presently based in a village called Ait al-Shab, which is near to Bin Jebel, which was sort of seen as some of the heaviest fighting during the invasion. I'm working with a sort of grassroots activist and volunteer network called Samadoun, which is based out of Beirut and comprises over 400, mainly sort of volunteers, although we have sort of teams of doctors and engineers, etc., working with us. And our main function at the moment in Ait al-Shab is the distribution of aid and just trying to see that it's distributed sort of equally and fairly in surrounding villages, as well as doing workshops and sort of role-playing activities with children and with different both Lebanese and international groups who are trying to demine the area. In terms of raising awareness about, you know, the situation in terms of cluster bombs and just trying to teach children how to identify, you know, the different unexploded ordnances and to stay away from them and how to mark them as well.
Quiva, we also have reports that an Israeli soldier was killed and three others wounded in southern Lebanon when their tank drove over a landmine believed to have been placed there by the Israeli military before they pulled out in 2000.
I mean, the situation in the south of Lebanon is, you know, that this policy, you know, of using ordinances which are designed for maximum impact and maximum civilian deaths, you know, that this is continuing. You know, that when the Israelis did that in 2000, obviously there were thousands of landmines planted, and that this has made, you know, life impossibly difficult, but particularly for farmers. And that's something that a lot of families are saying, you know, that they've already lost the tobacco harvest this year, you know, because they were under siege and unable to harvest their crops, but also now fields, you know, are completely unsafe for them to enter into. But a lot of these villages are comprised of subsistence farming families, you know, so this is, again, you know, how people will probably be either wounded or killed, you know, forced economically to harvest their crops and basically brave the dangers of the countryside just littered with cluster bombs. The school that we're working out of actually, with aid distribution, has a cluster bomb in one corner of it and three others on the roof. And the roof is the only spot where you can get phone reception, you know, in the entire sort of village. So it's, I mean, that's one example, but there are, you know, as mentioned in Anna's report, cluster bombs in people's kitchens, living rooms, backyards, schools, etc., all over the place.
Cuiva Betterly, you're particularly known for working with children, longtime peace activists, Irish peace activists. You spent 5 years working with refugees in Jenin. You were shot there by Israeli soldiers when you were trying to lead a group of Palestinian children to safety. Can you specifically talk about children right now and these unexploded ordnances, these unexploded bombs?
I think what, you know, we've seen in a lot of the villages that we've been touring is, I mean, it's hard to express, really, I think, people's sentiments at the moment, but there is, I mean, there's this feeling of great pride in I wouldn't call it a victory, but at least, you know, people having resisted on all levels, I think militarily and socially and politically, and sort of displaced people, you know, sort of braving the discomforts of being displaced, but that the fact that Lebanon was not reoccupied. But there is also, you know, a very crushed, traumatized sort of infrastructure and people, and we're seeing that more and more in children. I think like 10 sort of and up year olds are, you know, quite defiant and brave, and, you know, they sort of talk about having resisted the occupation or the attempted invasion and occupation. But, I mean, smaller children, you know, are just obviously traumatized. There were three children wounded in Ait El Shab, which is a village where we're based, a few days ago. One of them was seriously wounded and is still in intensive care in Sursh, in Tyre. But it's something that the children are very aware of, you know, and I think the sort of vulnerability that has impacted on their life, you know, having seen their family members killed and their homes destroyed, etc., is further enhanced by, you know, their mothers telling them, and their mothers are terrified, you know, the mothers that we speak to, but, you know, really that no place is safe to play, you know, and they know that, you know, that every time they go out that there is no safety. I mean, the last few nights that we've spent in the village, there have been tanks moving, you know, up and down the border. There's been drones and helicopters, and people are seeing this as deliberate sort of psychological intimidation, you know, as a way of really reminding them that they're being watched, that they're still not safe, you know, and people are terrified. Hamadoun, the group that I'm working with, was also working with displaced people in Beirut, and, you know, some of the nights that we were there, whenever there was an explosion or a sonic boom sort of above the camp, I mean, people would be sort of screaming and fainting, and you know, there's this deep trauma and a deep sense of vulnerability. But again, I mean, you know, people have to get on there with their lives, but the situation is pretty intolerable. There's no running water, no electricity, very basic sort of food stuff in terms of aid getting in, you know, and the threats, really, of the Israelis, you know, either coming back in or gratuitously sort of targeting Ait El Shab or any of the villages on the border again.
Cuiva Betterly, I want to thank you for joining us from southern Lebanon. Cuiva Betterly, longtime peace activist, has spent time in Iraq, long time in West Bank, and now spending time in southern Lebanon working with children and refugees who have returned back to their homes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. To see Anna Nagera's report online, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. When we return, we'll speak with Steve Goose about landmine legislation in Washington. Stay with us.
I was conceived among the ivory halls, and in this world I knew my role. I went to work with a single goal. I traveled the earth to far off lands, from the Asian jungles to the African sands. I flew in planes of camouflage green. before I settled upon this sea. Like a shooting star I came to rest, and this farmer's field is where I nest, watching the seasons come and go, watching the long grass grow and grow.
David Rovics, Ballad of a Cluster Bomb, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Steve Goose joins us on the phone right now from Washington, D.C., Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Arms Division, a leading expert on landmines and cluster munitions. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
As you've listened to the reports from southern Lebanon, can you comment on landmines and cluster bombs there?
Well, you've given a very strong and compelling report this morning on the problem of cluster munitions and other unexploded ordnance in Lebanon. I mean, the situation that we're seeing there is compelling testimony for why governments all around the world should no longer be using cluster munitions. And cluster munitions, along with landmines, are the weapon system, the conventional weapon system, that poses the greatest dangers to civilian populations. And it's time that governments just face up to the fact that these weapons shouldn't be used.
I wanted to ask about a bill introduced in the Senate this month that would block the Pentagon from beginning production of the first new landmines in nearly a decade. The bill was introduced by Senators Patrick Leahy and Arlen Specter and would bar production of landmines and other weapons that so-called victim activated. Can you talk about the significance of the legislation and what that means?
The legislation has sort of multiple purposes. One is just to move the U.S. closer to the community of nations that have already banned anti-personnel landmines. There's a 1997 treaty, the Mine Ban Treaty, that comprehensively prohibits the use, production, trade, and stockpiling of anti-personnel mines. And there are now 151 countries that are party to that. The U.S. is one of the few that's not. It's the only NATO country, for example, that is not. And this is designed to try and move the U.S. closer to the rest of the world in rejecting completely this weapon. But more particularly, it's aimed at stopping a Pentagon plan to produce a new weapon system called the Spider that, while usually is used in what's called command detonated mode, where a soldier decides when to set the munition off, has a special feature that has been added, which would turn it into a standard anti-personnel mine, the kind of thing that's already banned by so many other countries. And indeed, this would then constitute the first time since 1997 that the U.S. would produce a weapon that that qualifies as an anti-personnel mine.
Can you explain the difference, landmines, cluster bombs, what the international legislation is on this, where the U.S. stands on this?
Cluster bombs, cluster munitions, and landmines have a lot of similarities. As I mentioned before, the main one is the long-term threat that they both pose to civilians. The difference is that cluster bombs are designed to explode on impact. That's what they're supposed to do. They're problematic even during attack, and let me come back to that point in a minute, but they're designed to explode on impact. When they don't, they leave behind large numbers of what are typically called hazardous duds. Duds sounds benign. It's not. They're still live, and if you touch them or kick them or pick them up to play with, they're going to explode. They, in essence, become de facto landmines. That is what the vast majority of your report from southern Lebanon was all about, these duds that are left behind that act just like landmines, posing an indiscriminate danger to civilians. There is no international legislation that deals specifically with the problem of cluster munitions. There are the general rules against using weapons against civilians that apply to cluster munitions. There's a protocol to something called the Convention on Conventional Weapons that deals somewhat with the cleanup side of the problem of cluster munitions, but there's nothing specific on the weapon. We've been pushing governments who are part of this Convention on Conventional Weapons to take up the issue directly and agree to a new protocol that would regulate or hopefully prohibit inaccurate and unreliable cluster munitions. This contrasts with the landmine situation where we have had a treaty that entered into force in 1999 that the vast majority of the world has already signed on to that comprehensively prohibits the weapon.
And where does the U.S. stand on that?
The U.S., with the Clinton administration, under strong pressure from the Pentagon, refused to sign that treaty in 1997 and has not joined it since. The Clinton administration established an objective of joining this year, of joining in 2006, and instructed the Pentagon to search for alternatives to the weapon. The Bush administration undertook a review of that landmine policy and very regrettably decided not to join and, in fact, became the first nation to declare that it would never join. Even countries like China and Russia, who also haven't signed, have said that they eventually intend to join the treaty. But the U.S. has said that it wants to hold on to some of its high-tech anti-personnel mines indefinitely. So they've put themselves really outside of the rest of the world with their approach on this issue. And this search for alternatives, paradoxically, is what has led to this SPIDER system. SPIDER was supposed to be an alternative to anti-personnel mines, but the Pentagon, in its way, decided to add a feature that, in fact, turns it back into an anti-personnel mine.
Steve Goose, the recent list of casualties from unexploded Israeli ordnances also includes Israeli troops. One Israeli soldier was killed and three others wounded in southern Lebanon today when their tank drove over a landmine. Lebanese officials told the Associated Press the soldiers had entered a minefield, one of the many left over by the Israeli military after their troops withdrew from South Lebanon in 2000, at that time ending 18 years of occupation. Now, Israel's required to provide maps for the minefields in Lebanon under the UN ceasefire resolution that ended the latest fighting. Can you talk about the issue of landmines in Lebanon going back to 1982?
Yeah, well, it goes back even farther than that. Landmines were used there in the conflict in the 1970s as well, and it's not just Israel. All the parties who were fighting in the 1970s and 80s in Lebanon laid landmines, and Israel did lay the majority of them and apparently continued to use them up until the withdrawal in 2000. It's a huge problem in Lebanon. I mean, their estimates are that some 400,000 to half a million landmines were laid. And there has been a fairly vigorous effort since 2000 to get those mines out of the ground, and they now think that there are still some 2,500 minefields. That problem has now been exacerbated greatly by this recent conflict, not so much by landmines that have been laid. In fact, we don't know of any confirmed examples of Israel using mines in the most recent fighting, and there have only been a few spotty reports of Hezbollah laying landmines. But the overall problem of unexploded ordnance and explosive remnants of war has been exacerbated hugely by the cluster munitions in particular, but also by the other kinds of unexploded ordnance that comes from using rockets and missiles and even grenades and other things. So that the efforts that were made to protect the population from these kind of dangers has now just been set back hugely.
Steve Goose of Human Rights Watch is our guest. Earlier this month, the New York Times reported the Bush administration was set to approve an Israeli request to speed delivery of missiles armed with cluster munitions. The M26 rockets carry hundreds of grenade-like bomblets that explode over a wide area. Israel said it needed them to strike Hezbollah missile launchers. The U.S. halted the cluster bomb sales to Israel in 1982. That was under Reagan, after use against civilians, but rescinded that ban in 1988. Where is the U.S. getting these munitions from that they are sending to Israel? And can you comment on this?
Well, the U.S. produces, different companies in the U.S. produce a wide variety of cluster munitions and the submunitions that they carry. Indeed, the U.S. has an inventory of nearly 1 billion submunitions. The numbers are staggering when you start talking about cluster munitions and the submunitions that they carry. We used to be completely overwhelmed by the notion of 200 million landmines out there, but when we start talking about cluster submunitions, we're talking about billions that are already in the stockpiles of more than 70 countries around the world. They haven't been used as extensively as mines, and that's why they're not as hot an issue, but the future dangers are huge. Israel also produces large numbers of submunitions. They're one of the world's biggest producers as well, but they wanted this particular system from the U.S. they had ordered a number of years ago. A multiple-launch rocket system that, as you say, carries a staggering number of cluster munitions. And they wanted that delivery expedited. We came out very strongly against that because of the predictable dangers that would pose to civilian populations.
Can you talk about the companies that make these cluster bombs here in this country? The U.S. is the largest producer of cluster bombs.
Well, that's probably fair to say, although you never know what the arsenals are in places like Russia and China. With that caveat, certainly the U.S. is one of the largest producers, and it's the typical people who make these kind of munitions, a company like Textron or Alliant Tech Systems. But there are many U.S. companies that are involved in the business.
Do you have any names of those companies?
Well, two of the biggest would be Textron and Alliant. Textron in Massachusetts and Alliant Tech Systems in Minnesota.
Alliant is one of the companies where Minneapolis peace activists have protested for years outside that company as a result of this. And the legislation in Washington, how would it affect these companies? And how much support does it have? I mean, you've got a Republican and a Democrat, Leahy and Arlen Specter. Where do you expect it to go from here?
Well, it was just recently introduced, and they're still in the stage of gathering co-sponsors for the legislation. We think that there will be very strong support for it. Indeed, when the landmine issue was before Congress during the Clinton administration, a majority of senators were in favor of the Clinton administration signing the mine ban treaty. So there is a strong sentiment that the U.S. shouldn't be involved in this kind of activity. Of course, we only have a short time left for Congress to deal with any issue before it finishes up this session. So we're in the process here of building awareness in the Congress. But ultimately, we think that the Pentagon will get the signal that Congress is opposed to this and that the American public is opposed to this. And indeed, U.S. allies are opposed to this. One of the points that we've tried to make is that all of the U.S. allies who are part of the mine ban treaty, and as I say, that includes almost all of the EU and virtually all of NATO and many other key U.S. allies are part of this. And those who are part of the treaty cannot assist in any way with a prohibited act. That's one of the provisions of the mine ban treaty. So that we already have a number of those who are part of the treaty saying that they would have to divest in any U.S. companies that are involved in the production of this SPIDER anti-personnel mine system. Norway's already made that ruling, for example, with their huge multi-billion-dollar petroleum fund, that they would have to no longer be involved in investments with companies that are part of this weapon. So it'll create problems for the U.S., problems for U.S. companies, U.S. interoperability problems with its NATO allies. It's just a bad idea with no real benefit.
Steve Goose, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll link to Human Rights Watch website and your reports on this issue at democracynow.org. Steve Goose is Executive Director of Human Rights Watch's Arms Division, leading expert on landmines and cluster munitions. When we come back from our break, we'll look at the increasing incidence of sexual misconduct among military recruiters as the military aggressively recruits people into the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. Stay with us.
Hey, yo, a young kid wakes up, it's the last days of summer, out on his street. he peeps the Hummer blasting hip hop, which is his passion, not fashion. So he moves fast and passing kids, water fountain splashing. A crowd starts to grow as the last drop of water flows. His friends, yo, yo, who belongs to that car? Is it a rap star? Nah, son, it's the army you won. So this young man with no plan takes the hand of an army man. You know the recruiter, equipped with the fly computer, slick website, brochure to scoop ya. Scoop ya, scoop ya. We went from one love to an army of one. Co-op unity, sell it back to you with a gun. We went from one love to an army of one. Co-op unity, sell it back to you with a gun. We went from one love to an army of one. Co-op unity, sell it back to you with a gun. We went from one love to an army of one. Co-op unity, sell it back to you with a gun. We went from.
We should be able to live the life we choose. I choose to refuse to let my life just be used.
Recruit by Open Thought here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting on 500 radio and television stations in this country, in South America, on the web. Pacifica, NPR, PBS, and public access TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our transcripts are also there, and our headlines are in Spanish and transcript and audio form for stations to take. I'm Amy Goodman. Desperate for more troops, the U.S. Marines have announced that they're beginning an involuntary recall of inactive service members to return to duty and go to Iraq and Afghanistan. The number of U.S. troops in Iraq has now increased to 138,000. At the same time, sexual misconduct by military recruiters is on the rise. Let me read from an Associated Press expose. More than 100 young women who expressed interest in joining the military in the past year were preyed upon sexually by their recruiters. Women were raped on recruiting office couches, assaulted in government cars, and groped en route to entrance exams. The article goes on to quote an 18-year-old victim who says, "This should never be allowed to happen. The recruiter had all the power. He had the uniform. He had my future. I trusted him." In a moment, we'll be joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning AP reporter who exposed this story. But first, we broadcast excerpts of the AP television story. This is Barry Vogel, the lawyer for a 17-year-old girl who's suing the Marines.
She came from a family with limited means. She saw the Marines as something proud to do, a way to serve her country. And eventually, he said to her outright, "If you want to join the Marines, you have to have sex with me." She was a virgin. She was 17 years old, so she had sex with him eventually. When someone wants to join the Marines and is told by the gatekeeper that to join the Marines, you have to have sex with me, the power system, the position of authority, doesn't justify that. The Marine Corps knows about this, and they do nothing. They turn a blind eye to it. And I suspect that they laugh about it and guffaw about it.
Shedrick Hamilton is a former Marine recruiter who was convicted of having sex with a 16-year-old high school student who was interested in joining the Marines. Hamilton is serving 15 months in Oneida Correctional Facility in upstate New York.
To get caught up into the wrong situation at the wrong time, and I have no one to blame but myself. No matter which way I look at it, it's still my fault. And it's got to be more than just going out there, putting someone in a position to saying, "This is your mission. You have to make this. You have to make this." Because there's months when you just can't.
This is Pentagon spokesperson Bill Carr.
Any number greater than one sincerely is a concern, and particularly if it occurs amongst recruiting or in the training base, because at that point people are particularly vulnerable, and therefore the standards of behavior expected of officers and non-commissioned officers is considerably greater. Whether it was physical touching or even an offhanded comment, it's out of line, and it's not what the recruiting force is going to tolerate among itself.
Martha Mendoza joins us now. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning AP reporter who conducted this investigation into military recruiting and sexual misconduct. We invited a representative of the Pentagon to join us, but they did not respond to the request. Martha Mendoza, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you lay out your findings?
Yes, it took about 6 months for us to do enough Freedom of Information Act work as well as interviews. We read journals from a victim who had been victimized by a recruiter. During this time, what we found was more than 80 military recruiters had been disciplined in 2005 for sexual misconduct with potential enlistees. These cases were across all the branches of the military, and it took place all over the country.
Can you talk specifically about the numbers? You start your piece by talking about 100 women. Talk about the time frame. Talk about the cases we know and what you suspect about the cases we don't know.
Sure. There was 100 young women. Most of them were between 16 to 18 years old. One important thing to point out here is that this is a rate of one out of every 200 frontline recruiters who was disciplined for this, not just charged. What we found and in our review is that these were mostly students, high school or college students. Most of them were thinking about recruiting, and that the misconduct usually took place either in recruiting stations, in recruiters' apartments, or in government vehicles. It's a unique relationship where recruiters are allowed to be alone in a closed room or closed car with a young woman. It's rare in the world of counseling and coaching and teaching that you would find that.
The level of military response to the complaints.
Most of the cases are handled administratively, almost all of them, so that recruiters can be demoted, they can get letters of reprimand, they can be fined. On occasion, civilian courts, civilian prosecutors will step in and also take cases, and there are a small percentage of court-martial and severe penalties imposed in some of these cases.
Can you tell us more about the first clip we played? That's Barry Vogel representing a 17-year-old teen.
Yes, in this case, there was a recruiting station in Northern California where there was several recruiters who have since been charged and taken out of the Marines for what appeared to be a pattern in that office of sexual misconduct with potential recruits. And in that case, things got so bad that at one point there were three recruiters having sex in the front recruiting room office with three young women, all potential recruits. Many of the victims in that area said that they were being told if they wanted to join the Marines, they were going to have sex with these recruiters.
And how did you learn this?
I came across this entire story by talking to an attorney who was representing two young women who claimed to have been raped by recruiters. And he said he felt that there was more than just these two cases.
And what does it take for a young person to come forward and talk about their experience? I mean, you're talking about the end there, where they're suing.
They're extremely traumatized. In fact, this morning I'm planning to interview another young woman who was victimized in this way. They are traumatized for years. They are frightened of authority. The young women who do come forward and do something about this are courageous. They are preventing it from happening to someone else. And they mostly live in small communities where if this plays in their local paper, even if their name is not included, it's tough to protect their anonymity.
We're talking to Martha Mendoza. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning AP reporter, national investigative reporter, who has come out with an expose on military recruiters and the increasing incidence of sexual misconduct. Can you tell us about Shedrick Hamilton, the man we just saw and heard in prison now? I think his sentence is 15 months. Tell us about his case.
He was charged with a handful of counts of rape. He was from upstate New York. He was a recruiter who had been serving in the Marines for 7 years. In this case, the charges were reduced to a third-degree rape, and he says he's very, very remorseful about what happened. He realizes that his life has been ruined, his military career, his family, and he also says that he's very sad about what became what happened to his victim, who was a 16-year-old girl at the time.
How do these recruiters meet these young women?
Well, under the No Child Left Behind Act in 2002, public schools have to provide lists of all the names and phone numbers of their students, and in many cases, emails as well, and cell phones as well, to the military recruiters. If they don't provide these lists, then the schools do not get federal funds. And unless the parents or the students go through a special process to opt out of being included on this list. So recruiters have unprecedented access to young people right now. And they are on high school and college campuses, of course, just like any other employer is allowed on a high school or college campus. And they develop relationships with the young person they're trying to recruit. They learn at recruiting school to build trust and develop a close relationship. It's very hard on the recruiters who are working teenage hours. And I want to be clear that there's many good recruiters out there who are doing their jobs as diligently as they can. Right now is a very tough time to be a military recruiter because of the war in Iraq. It's making it less likely that people are going to want to enlist.
Looking at the Indianapolis Star. They did a report how in Indiana, six female high school recruits were sexually assaulted by a recruiter in 2002-2003. Indiana National Guard Sergeant Eric Vitizi, quote, picked out teens and young women with backgrounds that made them vulnerable to authority. As a military recruiter, he had access to personal information, making the quest easier. The local prosecutor noted that of the victims, young women between the ages of 17 and 21, most were in single-parent families with no father figure. Because Vitizi assembled the background information on each recruit, he was able to target those he most likely could coerce.
Sergeant, it's pronounced Betsy, has not had his trial yet. It's going to be in early 2007. The charges are by far the most egregious of any of the cases I came across. He was charged with throwing girls up on counters and being very, very forcible and very rough with very young girls. His case is remarkable in that there were 31 different counts. And that the prosecutor, in addition to charging rape and sexual assault, is charging a racketeering charge because they're saying he abused his position of official power. One thing that is also interesting about Eric Vetsy's case is that the Indiana Army National Guard didn't just sit on their hands and say this is a problem. They have instituted what I believe is the only program in the country called No One Alone. Male recruiters cannot be alone in offices, cars, or anywhere else with female enlistees. If they are, they risk immediate disciplinary action. They'll also be disciplined if they hear of another recruiter's misconduct and don't report it. And the director of the Indiana Army National Guard says that just a year into this program, they're having a lot fewer problems. He said, it's almost like we're changing the culture in our recruiting.
Can you talk about how you get information, Martha Mendoza? I mean, you're talking about the Army, the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Air Force. How centralized is this information about the number of cases of sexual abuse?
Well, I thought it was going to be easier to get the information than it was. I began with very routine Freedom of Information Act requests to the Defense Department, which immediately told me they don't oversee and coordinate recruiter misconduct or any type of these cases. I then sent out individual Freedom of Information Act requests to the Army, Marine Corps, Navy, and Air Force, and found that part of the problem here may be that nobody is tracking these cases. So I did dozens of Freedom of Information Act requests and found myself having to track down who might have pieces of information about court martials, which are kept in one area, and disciplinary reprimands in another area, and myself provide the Freedom of Information Act researchers in those branches of the military with who they should contact within their own military organization to get me the numbers that I was requesting. So a big piece of this story was getting the numbers. I went into it wondering, well, were there two cases that this attorney is suing over and that had been played out in a military court, or were there more? It surprised me to find 80 military recruiters disciplined in 2005. That was a much higher number than I think anyone had anticipated. But in addition to the numbers, it was a case of trying to get people to talk to me about it. I wanted to understand from a victim's perspective how this could happen. And I wanted to understand from recruiters' perspectives as well. So I spent time following recruiters at their work. And as you saw, I interviewed recruiters who have been charged and disciplined. I spent a good deal of time talking to victims as well and to sexual assault experts about these cases.
And how does this affect the recruitment of young women into the military?
Well, I don't know. That will come to pass. You mean in terms of young women who are being victimized during the process?
Yes, and then others who hear about it. In fact, a GAO report came out on this, Government Accountability Office report, talking about just one of these stories and how it infects the whole community.
Yeah, I think certain recruiting offices and certain recruiting officers do get reputations. It's hard for me to quantify what it is that's making it very difficult for recruiters these days to meet their numbers that they're supposed to be meeting. One interesting number I came across was that half of the 16 to 24-year-olds in this country are not eligible to be signed up for the military at this point due to their test scores or to their education. So the recruiters have a much smaller pool to even seek from right now. I should mention that the GAO report you talked about there came out last week, and what it showed was that overall recruiter misconduct, and that's signing people up and not telling them the truth when they're doing it and other types of wrongdoing, has increased from 400 cases in 2004 to 630 cases in 2005.
We're hearing about increasing number of women who have suffered. On June 15th, police in Eugene, Oregon, arrested a 21-year-old Army specialist for refusing to return to fight in Iraq. You may be familiar with this case. The soldier is named Suzanne Swift. She served in Iraq for a year, but decided this time she could not return. Like thousands of other soldiers, she went AWOL. Not only did she feel that the war lacked purpose, but she said her superiors repeatedly sexual assaulted and harassed her while she served in Iraq. She ultimately remained AWOL until June, when the Eugene police knocked on her mother's front door. It was 10:30 at night. Suzanne was arrested, taken to the county jail. Then she was transferred to Fort Lewis in Washington, forced to return to her unit, but barred from leaving the base. Do you know the story of Suzanne Swift now trying to get out of the military, accusing her superiors of harassment?
Yeah, I am familiar with her case. I haven't done any reporting into it. I have done a fair bit of reporting into people who are trying to get out of the military right now and how those numbers are increasing. The conscientious objectors, as well as people who are getting out for other types of reasons, weight, drugs, alcohol. Her case is unique in that I'm not sure she made an attempt to get out through one of the official channels. I think she was victimized and traumatized, and I haven't interviewed her and I haven't read the case files on it.
Are you going to follow up this AP expose with another?
Well, that's my job, luckily. I'm very fortunate at the AP to have a role where I get to do a lot of investigative reporting. And on this story, I believe the follow-ups, the next step is going to be that in Congress, there's people calling for increased penalties for sexual misconduct by military recruiters now, as well as members who are saying we need to look at the entire recruiting process and figure out what's going wrong. So I believe that's where the initial follow-ups are going to come.
Well, Martha Mendoza, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Won the Pulitzer Prize writing for AP, now has done this expose on sexual harassment by military recruiters. We will link to your story at democracynow.org. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Dokadoush, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Frank Lopez, and Jen Utes. Special thanks to Jeremy Scahill. And special thanks to Anna Nogueira reporting to us from Lebanon. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Thanks also to Luai Abu Asma, John Randolph, Peter Yoon, Kieran Craig Meadows, Jillian O'Connor, Megan Whitney, Danielle Strandberg Peshkin, Angela Alston, and Uri Galeb. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.